So it's our gift, Danny's our gift to you with the information he's put together on how you can not worry too much but know exactly where we are and how we can all be happy and have a better politics. So passing on Professor Danny Dorling.
Thank you. Thanks ever so much for coming. I don't have many notes. These are my notes. I have to remember to talk on this. You can read them from there. So this is why everything is wrong and how to make it better. It's not hard to find reasons as to why everything is wrong. Now, if you want to know what I think, you could just flip me up on the internet and Google it. But what I want to start off with is something you can't find me saying because I don't believe it. But that is that everything that is wrong is caused by immigration. But what I want to start off by doing is getting some interaction from you. So I want you to think about any social problem, and I'll try and show you how easy it is to blame it on the immigrants. So, have we got anybody who can think about any social problem in society at the moment? Preferably just a short issue like, go on.
Housing shortage.
Housing shortages is entirely caused by the immigrants. They've been streaming in here, filling up our houses, getting points, they get into social housing, they breed, and then they get ill and they get even more points for it. They have tons of money, they buy houses, they don't build any houses because there aren't any Polish builders. They don't make bricks because we make all our bricks in this country, and it's the immigrants that are entirely responsible for the price of housing in this country. Nothing to do with the way we arrange housing. I will talk against this in a minute, but let's just try one a bit harder. Try and think of something which you think it can't be the immigrant's fault, and I'll show you how it can be.
Global warming.
Global warming is terrible. If we could stop immigration, then people wouldn't come to this country. Now, this country, of course, we fly a lot. We have a very high footprint, very high carbon footprint, and we're trying to be good. We recycle, but, you know, we deserve it. We've worked hard. We've created an empire. We deserve to have a good quality of life. We deserve to have our cars. But if we're going to carry on being green, we need to stop immigrants because they'll come into this country and they'll get cars like us and they'll pollute. So immigration is bad because it increases global warming. I don't believe a word of this. It's dead easy to do. Go on, give me another one.
Agoraphobia.
Homophobia. Or it's particularly those Christian fundamental immigrants coming in from their churches abroad with their backwards attitude. You know, we're really advanced. We love gay people. Even our Prime Minister loves gay people. Forget Clause 28, you know, that was in the past. You know, we're now a caring, cosmopolitan society. All that's holding us back are these medieval views that come in from abroad. It's not just the particularly evangelicals coming in from parts of... I mean, I could start getting racist if you want, but I won't, because I do find that quite difficult. But coming in from Africa, but of course there's the Muslims. You know, they've got a real problem with gay people. So you can blame homophobia on immigrants if you like. There's one at the back. They drive down wages. Yes, they come in, they're willing to work for nothing. And if they didn't come, we would have to pay people who clean our houses more and more and more, because there wouldn't be enough people. Of course, we'd still have lots of money to pay those people to clean our houses. But immigrants are willing to work for very little, whereas British people have a certain standard. And so we'd be a much better off country if the immigrants didn't come, because we'd all be paying each other more, because we'd create wealth out of somewhere, and that wealth would make us wealthier and wages would go up without the immigrants. Let's have another couple, just because I want to change...
Obesity.
Oh, that is harder. That is harder. This is a challenge. Because immigrants on average tend to be a bit thinner than we are. There's only one country in the world, rich country in the world, which is fatter than us, which is the United States. We are the fattest people in Europe. So it's difficult. But we have a lot of immigrants from the United States. And you may not know this. I won't ask any of you Americans who are here to identify yourselves. The highest concentration of foreign-born children in Britain isn't in Peterborough or, I don't know, Grimsby. Grimsby worries about immigrants, there aren't any in Grimsby.
That's why they're worried.
They're worried, they're going to Doncaster Road. But the biggest concentration of immigrants is in Hyde Park. And it's actually children born in America. This is immigrants under the age of 15. So we're allowing these Americans to come in. They run our banks now. With their children who are going to become fat like them. And then we will have to pick up the price for that. And of course, all these immigrants coming in and doing our labouring jobs means that we're not actually going out and doing work that used to make us thinner. All those immigrants, you know, working hard, you know, we just sit there on the slightly better jobs getting fat in our offices. So it was a hard one. But try another one. It can be merely obscure, and I'll have a go blaming the immigrants.
Trident.
Well, a trident, of course, is our glorious defence system that's keeping us so safe. I want to have a hat, which I wear when I do this, which says, I don't believe a word of this, but let me go. Trident, if it wasn't for Trident, we'd be overrun by now. Trident has kept the world safe, mutually assured structurally, it makes a lot of sense. We can't trust these immigrants. They don't all have our interests at heart and our understanding. For a start, we will have to keep Trident safe for them, because some of them might actually try to get control of it. They might, you know, try to create explosions from uranium that they managed to get from their missiles. Immigrants have always been dangerous when it comes to bombing. We had bombs from Jewish immigrants in 1905. It's always been a problem. But the real threat from Trident of immigration is that these immigrants come and they have children, and those children get classified as British. This is terrible. They get called British because they're born here, and they get a right to vote when they grow up, and they might vote in future because they have their strange continental ideas and come from countries, or their parents come from countries which have relied on us defending them with our nuclear missiles because they're not man enough to have their own. These immigrants who come from these strange places might one day vote for, I don't know, some mad person who doesn't believe in Trident to be Prime Minister. And that would leave our country defenceless. But if we close the doors now, if we can stop immigration now, if we vote for freedom and democracy now, we can keep our nuclear weapons for decades and centuries ahead, and maybe one day even get to use them. If we stop immigration. Let's just do one do you think it's really hard that can in no way be connected to immigration?
The banking crisis.
Okay. Oh, the banking crisis is too easy. The banking crisis was immigrant ideas of derivatives that came over from the United States, but also some Swiss bankers and some other people. You know, we're very clever, but we didn't actually invent the idea of derivatives ourselves. There's one at the front.
Ash Dieback.
I'm going. My wife, I went about my wife, who has some responsibility for worrying about Ash Dieback, and can tell you what kind of, what's it called, fungicide? She's too shy. Fungicide you need to have. She knows the answer to your never Ash Dieback. To stop it spreading, because Ash Dieback is spread partly by human beings travelling between woods and spreading it. Of course, it's a continental disease. All diseases are continental diseases. We are pure. No diseases begin here. And if we had better border controls, as I have in Australia, that wonderful country with a point system for immigration and a big ocean, if we had better border controls, we would stop the spread of diseases, and Ash Dieback wouldn't have come. And I'm sure if we try hard enough, we could identify the immigrant who first brought it over to this country on their boots, who didn't know about the correct fungicide to use because they hadn't been looking at Natural England's website in great detail. Okay, we'll start with the immigrants there. The immigrants are easy. It's an easy one to go for. And the immigrants have been a stable part of British political rhetoric for a century and a half. The first immigrants we hated were the Irish. The Irish had a famine entirely of their own creation, as far as our history tells the story, and then they came over here in droves and wrecked the middle of cities like Liverpool and Manchester, and did terrible things like build our canals and build our railways at low labour costs. Then we worry particularly about the Jewish immigrants from the pogroms in Russia, who came over in large numbers, and they had some anarchists and they had some terrorists, and they were really bad. We kind of changed our mind about Jewish immigrants in 1944 and 1945, and it became unacceptable then to talk about how terrible Jewish immigrants were because of what happened in Germany. And within 30 or 40 years, you could have a conservative cabinet with the children of a large number of Jewish immigrants in. Things changed. Then we worried about all the immigrants we got from the Caribbean. Why did we get them? We actually stopped having babies in the 1930s. Our fertility rate went right down. In the 1930s, the government produced projections saying the country would run out of people by the year 2000. We're having so few babies. Now, we actually had more babies again after the Second World War, but because we hadn't had babies in the 1930s, there was a lack of people aged 30 in the 1960s. What did we do? We went out to the Caribbean, and we went out to select in Asia to ask people to come and work in this country, to drive buses in London and to work in mills on the night shift, because we couldn't get people here to work again. Birth rate went up. This is great, because I got born 1968. 1967 was the summer of love. That's the reason I'm around. And then it went down again in the 1970s. So what happens 30 years after 1970s when we don't have many babies? But we have lots of things that need to be done. We have lots of people coming again. Have we ever welcomed lots of people coming? No, we haven't. We've always moaned about it. Partly because it stops you actually asking, why is our housing expensive? Why is it the most expensive in Europe? Why has it been the most expensive in Europe for decades? Why was it expensive even when we didn't have much immigration, 30 years after we actually had quite a lot of babies of our own? Why did we have the smallest rooms in our housing in Europe? Why do we have the worst tenancy agreements in Europe? Why can any of you who are privately renting come home tonight and find a letter through your letterbox telling you you've got 2 months to get out? It isn't the immigrants. It isn't immigrants that actually created our rules about property or our ideas that it's okay for a few people to get a huge amount of money and for other people to have to pay an enormous amount of rent. It was us. It's we ourselves who have created the country that we live in. It is immigrants who disproportionately build the few houses and flats that we are building. It is immigrant bricks that we have to bring in because we no longer make enough bricks. In that, does anybody know I've forgotten? I can't remember all my facts. Where's the concentration of brick making in Britain?
Bedford.
Great. And who came over to make the bricks in Bedford?
Italians.
It's Italians. Concentration of those terrible Italian immigrants making bricks where the bricks are made in Britain. But when the housing crash came and we stopped building houses, the brickworks had to close down, and so we now have to bring in bricks from abroad. People talk about needing to build more housing. We do need to build some more housing, particularly around Oxford and in London. We could build more housing. The only reason we can actually build more housing is we can bring in builders from the continent and bricks to build it, because we do not have enough skilled builders in this country, because we have a housing market that does this, lays people off and brings them on again. Or you could look at schools. People classically talk about the problem is I can't find a place in the school I want to be in, because we've created an education system unlike the rest of the world where you think It's a great idea if you have a choice over schools, which means you need lots more school places to do a choice. So people say, oh, I can't get into school I want to be in because of that child who's got a name a bit different to my child's name. Well, it's much easier if they've got a skin colour that's a bit different to my child's skin colour. And so that's the reason that I can't get into the school I want to. There's two issues with that. The majority of immigrants in our schools are not the school children. They are the teaching assistants and the teachers. Our schools are disproportionately staffed by young, skilled people who we have not paid for their education. Another country has educated them. We have let them come in, and that is how our schools work. Traditionally, it was from New Zealand and Australia. Because New Zealand and Australia, although they're very exciting to us, are very, very boring if you're 15, 16, 17 or 18. Europe looks very exciting. You come over to Europe a bit later in your 20s with your teaching qualification, and you can live in Earl's Court for a bit. I do tend to stereotype, but now the whole of Europe can supply teachers and other people who look after our schools, including the caretakers of schools. And the proportion of staff in our schools who are overseas born is higher than the proportion of children. Partly because, of course, most of the children who we talk about as immigrants are not immigrants, they were born in Britain. They're British. The biggest increase in the last few years in children being born in Britain was in London. London is becoming more British than anywhere else. Because people who came over before, who were not born in the UK, are having children in London. It all becomes quite complicated. But the other, much more important reason why it is not immigrants that stop your children getting to the school you want your children to be in, is that we have a problem with schools. There is only one other country in the OECD which is more segregated in its schooling than us, and that is Chile. And I feel a certain embarrassment. This is terrible. 3 years of working in Oxford, and you find it hard to talk about. 7% of our children go to private schools. Those private schools take up over a quarter of the amount of money we spend on secondary education. That creates an idea that it's okay to spend a lot more on some children than others. And that idea then percolates into the church and the state system. And so we then begin to get a graduation in state schools. The graduation started in the 1990s when we produced the first school league tables. And what slowly happened from the 1990s onwards is the school in the posh part of town, which had often been a former secondary modern before it became a comprehensive, becomes more desirable. Middle class parents move towards it. Whichever school has slightly higher exam results, and the school in the slightly posher town, part of town, will have slightly higher exam results. That attracts the middle class. The house prices go up. The GCSE results go up. The GCSE results of the school they might have gone to go down, and you begin to get this differentiation in cities. Then you get parents with paranoia about primary school places. Because if you can't get your child into the right primary school, will they get into that secondary school? And if they can't get into the correct secondary school, will they get to university and be able to take out that massive debt, the biggest debt we've ever offered our young people in this country? And because we care about our children, we want this. I think we have an awful lag in our thinking about education. I went to a normal school. If you were to line all the schools of Britain up, from poorest to poshest, mine was in the middle, which meant that 2% of us went to university. If my parents, instead of sending me to that school, had sent me to a private school, my chances of going to university would have been 10 times higher. It really would have made some sense. You know, the amount of money they're spending would have increased my chances tenfold. Today, if you want your child to get into a Russell Group university, as long as they're not going to the bottom school in your town, they've got a pretty good chance of going, especially if you help them with their homework. There really is no need to send them to a private school. Private schools rely on you not knowing that, and they rely on you thinking the chances are the same as they were when you were young. But you might be sending your child to a private school because it's safer. You're keeping them away from the riffraff. The amount of drugs in schools in England is directly proportional to how many £20 notes there are in your wallet that you would not notice if your child took one. The amount of marijuana smoked in the poorest schools in Britain is very, very low, because the parents of the children in the poorest schools would notice if £20 went missing. Drugs cost money. In every city I have lived in, the drug use amongst 15, 16-year-olds, 17-year-olds is highest in the poshest comprehensive, because there is more money. But it's not as high as in the private schools, because there's a lot more money. We don't talk about this very much. It's hard to get facts. The best place to get anecdotal evidence on this is to be in London late at night, as I often am, standing at the bus stop at Park Lane, waiting for the bus to Oxford, and listening to the conversations of people like me of my age talking about the drug problem in the private school they send their children to. I happen to enjoy this as a hobby. But we have a remarkably mucked up school system. I can give you some much harder statistics. PISA, the International Education Organisation, who I don't particularly like, do some very bog standard tests of maths problem solving and literacy. On all these tests, these three different areas, but maths, numeracy is the best one because it's most comparable internationally. Maths is maths is maths. The UK and USA score near the bottom for the rich countries of the world, and the bulk of European countries and Japan score near the top at age 15. I could show you graph after graph, but I won't because it does get boring, even to me. So you have to believe my graphs. The relationship is there at age 15. Our 15, 16-year-olds do worse than other ones, but it's a bit cloudy. What's fascinating with these graphs is what happens if you measure children's ability when they grow up at age 24. If you give them a math test in Italy and France and Denmark and USA and here, I won't say, have we got any 24-year-olds in the room? I won't. 24, 25? I won't let you do anything. Okay. What did you get at GCSE maths?
A-star.
But my mum's
a maths teacher.
Yeah, yeah. So you got A-star at GCSE maths. Okay, this will make my, I won't do anything else. Don't worry. Don't be frightened. Got A-star at age 16. When we test again at age 24, we're right down at the bottom, along with the USA, which is similar to us. Not as bad with private schools, we are the worst after Chile, but the USA segregates by school zone. So how come we're bad at age 15, 16 on average, and then so much worse at your age? It's because what we're doing in our schools is teaching people to get an A-star, because an A-star really matters. Or we're teaching a lot of the rest of the population to get a C, because you can join the police if you get a C. There's a whole lot of other jobs you need a C in maths, and you can't if you get a D. So we teach people to get particular exam results on particular days. This really matters in this country because we have the widest economic inequalities in Europe. So if you get a D, you'll probably be living in poverty for most of your life. And if you get an A star, you're on track to being the best off 10%. And it doesn't really matter if you can't tell me Pythagoras' theorem, which is very simple, which I won't ask you, which is what you need for grade B maths. Okay? And it doesn't matter because you can forget maths if you don't go on to do physics or chemistry or want to become a maths teacher. There's no need for you ever again to know it. When I was talking in teaching in the University of Sheffield, that was 13 years ago to 3 years ago, I used to test our undergraduates who got AAB at A level whether they could work out VAT. Now it was 17.5%, but they couldn't. We've now raised VAT just to make it easier for you to. Children with AAB at A level couldn't work out 17.5% of numbers. I get phoned up by people of my age who are very well educated, my wife knows who I'm talking about, asking for help so they can help their children aged 14 with their homework because they can't do the maths at 14. We are undereducated. And this is the nature of the country we are compared to other countries. Let me get off education, let me get on to health, and then I'll ask you some questions because I don't want to drone on too much about things. Our housing, I'd argue, is one of the worst housing systems in Europe. London is the most expensive large city in the world. Now, the only good thing about London is you can place bets on when that bubble's going to crash. I mean, if you like doing it. It'll crash within 10 years. Because in 10 years' time, all those university students with the largest debt in history turn 31. The winners over those students will have a debt of over £100,000 to repay. So that's £100,000 you can take off their purchasing power in the housing market. 10 years is the longest you can give them on the market. Things have changed in the last 4 or 5 days. I don't think we're going to Brexit. Brexit would, and still could, crash the housing market. It's a question of where it goes and what we do. I've talked about education and what I think about education. Health, we don't score well on health. We particularly don't score well on mental health. 1 in 10 people in Scotland are taking Prozac every day, or the equivalent of Prozac. The figures in England have been too low. Of course, that means that the population won't be as anxious and depressed. It does have an effect. But you really don't want to be in a situation where you are self-medicating at this rate. 6,000 children die every year in the UK. You have to go to Romania to find a similar rate of infant and child deaths. Because we have one of the highest poverty rates in Europe, which is what you get if you have these great inequalities. We do have one very good thing when it comes to health, which is we have the most efficient health service in the world. 5 separate reports have said that the NHS is incredibly efficient. However, we are funding it relatively less and less and less. You might claim it's ring-fenced. The claims of ring-fencing are lies, by the way. Education is ring-fenced, apart from 16 and 17. So schools have had massive cuts in their sixth forms. Health is ring-fenced, apart from what happens when people leave hospital, which is adult social services, which is why your beds get blocked. Which is partly why we had the biggest rise in deaths last year that I think we have seen since the war. The number of people who died in England rose by about 5%. The number of people who died in Scotland rose about 9%. This is about 30,000 extra people dying in the country. The government blamed it on the flu. They also blamed the flu for the rise in 2012 and 2013. There will come a point where they cannot blame it on the flu anymore, particularly as we didn't manage to find much evidence of the flu in the labs we have to detect flu. It is completely disingenuous what is going on. And it's part of the reason why our life expectancy is not as high as it should be and our health is worse. The population has surveyed. Do you remember David Cameron bringing out a happiness index? Wellbeing index? Do you think anybody's looked at what it shows? We're in an amazing country where none of the four chief medical officers, Northern Ireland, Wales, Scotland and England, all have a chief medical officer. Not a single one of the chief medical officers has commented on the rise in people dying in this country. ONS, who collect the data for the Wellbeing Index, have no responsibility to point out to you that the most important component of it, which is what people say about their health, you're asked, is your health good, excellent, poor, fair, has shot down in the last few years. And in the latest data, released in March, the fall in self-rated health was below the confidence limits for the year before. But you just set up a happiness index. You don't actually look at what it shows you. When it comes to health, our NHS is incredibly efficient. And we're lucky about that, because if it wasn't as efficient as it is, if we didn't still have well-being at the levels we do, we'd be in dire trouble. There was a peak in over four-hour waits on trolleys in Scotland, January, February and March last year, which coincided partly with the rises. People were dying on trolleys, elderly women mainly, before they could get to be seen. But our health system does what it can with the money. The money per head is less than they pay anywhere else in Europe, apart from Greece and Italy in Western Europe. The East pays less, it has less money. And Greece and Italy have only started spending less on their health since the economic crisis. In France, they spend about 27% more per head on health. In Germany, it's about 40%. If we wanted to fund our health service at the rate the Germans fund their health service, we would have to find just over £1 billion more a week to spend on our health service. That's how much we are underfunding our health service compared to what the Germans choose to fund on their health service. It's actually 1,050 million. Now you should compare that with the claim that we will be able to spend an extra 350 million if we left Europe, which is going to win the prize for the most disingenuous statistic of all time, I suspect, this year. But forget the 350, the amount of money we should be spending on our health service is about £1 billion more a week if we want a German-style health service. How did the Germans manage to do that? Is it because they're good at making cars? It's a little bit because they're good at making cars. But it's mainly because in Germany they choose to tax people at a normal rate. So taxes are higher in Germany and you get a better health service. And taxes on high incomes are higher still. And that doesn't raise very much money. This is one that George Osborne just can't get. High marginal tax rates in Germany don't raise much money, but they're very good for taxation. Because in Germany, people who run companies, people in charge of universities, don't ask for big pay rises, because if they got a big pay rise, most of it would go in tax. What they do instead is they agree that the people working in their companies and their universities can have higher pay, people on average pay can have higher pay, and their taxes fund the health system for. In our country, the top 1% pay over a third of all income tax. And so isn't this a wonderful thing that we're paying over a third of all income tax? They only pay over a third of all income tax because they pay themselves so highly and arrange for other people to be paid so little that they can't pay much tax. And our overall tax take is lower. A graph, I'll do a plug. There are only two graphs in this book. This is another one of these books I've been too productive in the last few years, because my workload depends on inequality. If inequality rises, I have to write more books. If inequality can fall, I can slow down and get a normal life, and I don't have to write more books. But in this book, this is called A Better Politics, there are two graphs. One graph shows you why you will never buy a house if you're under 35, if things carry on as they are. And the other one shows you the tax rates that are levied in every other country in Europe. And it starts at the top, I think it starts with Finland. About 57% of all income in Finland is taxed. Do you want to guess who has the best schools in the world? It might be unrelated, you know, but Finland. And then you go through Sweden, Norway, Germany, France, Denmark, and so on. Then you have to go a long way down until eventually you get to us and Ireland. And Ireland has the biggest debt of all. And we are heading to get our tax rate below that of the United States. Which country has the worst infant mortality in the world? It's the United States. To me, these things just seem so obvious that if there are other countries, I'm a geographer, if there are other affluent countries where the way in which they educate their children means that their children are more able, which means that they can produce better cars, better ideas, more patents, things you can actually measure, it would be better to have the educational system of those countries rather than an education system that divides our children so that they're strangers from each other later on in life. If other countries have ways of dealing with housing, take Germany, where half of it's rented but you have decent rights as a tenant, and where they have controlled housing inflation since the war, so you do not buy a house as an investment, why don't we look there? The reason we don't look there is because our Chancellor believes that economic success is shown by high house prices. So the higher the house prices go, the more successful he has been. This is why, since 2010, George Osborne has spent more money on every budget on housing than anything else. Help to Buy. The latest Help to Buy scheme. If any of you want to buy a flat in London for £590,000, well, you've got a child, you're fairly well off, you're going to help that child a bit. Might be a two-bed flat for £590,000. Somewhere convenient. Shall we all lend them 40% of the mortgage? Would you like to do that? Don't have a choice. We're going to lend them 40% of the mortgage. That's the government's Help to Buy scheme. The government is lending people huge mortgages because the banks won't, because the banks know a bit about housing markets, to push the price of housing up. Because the higher the house prices are, the better the economy's doing. The very expensive houses, of course, are only for the people who go to the very expensive schools. But that's okay, because the way the government thinks, only a few people could ever be as clever as George and Dave and Boris. And most of you don't have it in you. And if things were left to you, or the people you might like to vote for, if you weren't scared of the immigrants, then this country would go to wreck and ruin. But if you leave it to them, Britain can be made great again. We will, the Chancellor told us 2 years ago, by 2030 we're going to become the richest country in the world if we follow the plan. I think he might... No, I don't think he believes it. I don't think he's that stupid. But I think he knows that saying this works for a certain proportion of the electorate. It only has to work for 30% of the electorate. You only need the votes of 30, less than one in three people to win an absolute majority of seats in the House of Commons. And you need the rest of the population to divide their votes between a whole set of parties that don't like each other and waste them. And you need a lot of people to not vote. Because if those people who don't vote did vote, the people who don't vote, it's not in their interest. And if it looks like those people might vote, you change the registration system so that they have to individually register themselves. A household can't do it. And who's unlikely to register themselves? People who have to move house every 2 years. In London, I think it's now about every 2.5 years, families who are privately renting are moving and changing school every time. Great, they'll forget to register to vote. And even better, you hand the electoral roll. Do you know you tick on the electoral roll whether you want to be private? even if you take the I Want to Be Private box, CACI and Experian, the two largest credit information companies in Britain, get a copied letter of woe so they can tell your creditors where you are. So if you're in debt, you don't go on letter of woe. And we can keep this going a little bit longer. The good news, got about 10 minutes of questions, that wasn't just the good news. The good news is that there is no way this can continue. As I've said, your housing market is going to crash in 10 years' time, unless aliens come from another planet with bars of platinum to buy the houses. The good news is that the education system is not in the interest of hardly anybody now, because the universities will take you in. The Russell Group have increased their take by 7% in both of the last 2 years. They will take you in, it's £9,000. But you do need to worry about what you're getting for your £9,000. And the really good news is that the children of the middle class are now looking at a future which is very bad, unless you're in the 1%. And even if you're in the 1%, that requires an income of £160,000, £200,000 for two of you. Even if you're in the 1%, without Help to Buy, you can't buy a three-bed semi in Fulham. You need to go to Mum and Dad and ask them for help. You cannot sustain a system which is not in the interest of 99% of people without a remarkable manufacture of fear. Without taking over the debate, so you and your friends who all went to Oxford when I grew up there, all of them, every single one of them, Dave, George, Boris, Michael, Teresa, she did a job for my department, she's keeping very quiet, my money's on her for the future. What you do as a group is you need to control the news agenda, which you can do with a referendum campaign, and then you'll need to think of something else and something else. Terrorists are great. By the way, stop worrying about, if any of you do, about ever being killed by a terrorist. You are 1,000 times more likely to be killed when you drive away from here. Do worry about that. It's a great way of thinking about driving carefully. If you just think, if I think about driving carefully, I need never worry about another terrorist in my life again. And there'll be another one and another one, because the government are not going to change their view about how the world works. They formed their view, like I formed my views largely, shortly after puberty, while at university. They've waited until May 2015 to finally be allowed, without the fettered Liberal Democrats holding them back, to put in place the plan that they've known would work ever since they fell in love with Margaret Thatcher shortly after puberty. You don't spend your whole life sacrificing yourself, becoming an MP on that terribly low salary and not taking the job in the city that your friends have taken. You don't do that not to enact the plan, not to privatise the schools through academy change, not to cut the NHS down so far that you can bring in the private companies. We're going to see a very rough 3 or 4 years to come, because a load of boys and a few girls who were teenagers in Oxford when I was a teenager have a fantasy, and they're going to play their fantasy out. But out of this, we could get something very, very new, because they're not playing the clever old game. The clever old game is you look after the whole 10%. You even look after 30% of society. That's how you win elections in the majority of the century. Looking after 1% of society and trying to fool those just below the 1% to think they could get there. How many of the 10% are going to get in the 1%? You know, you can work it out, even though you have English maths education. Right? So only 1 in 10 of the 10% can get into the winner group. But they're trying to get the other 90% in society to be preoccupied by the immigrants who do not live and have not turned up where they live apart from the doctor that they go to. This plan isn't going to work. Please ask me questions. We've got to be off stage exactly on the hour. Got some time.
Which way is the vote going to go and why?
Okay, my prediction for the vote, I was predicting before the events last week a narrow Remain vote. I tend to get my predictions often wrong. I should tell you, particularly on the housing market, I never predicted you'll get this high. Narrow Remain out of fear of you simply tell people your pensions won't be paid. And those pensioners from Spain are going to try to come back because they can't afford private healthcare in Spain. You know, we've got a really bad deal with Europe. We export our elderly to somebody else's health system to look after. We bring in young people that we haven't educated. Can you imagine what happens to the economy when you stop doing that? So Project Fear would have been blown out of all proportion, Remain. As it is, I honestly think it's going to become a vote of would you vote on the side of the man who killed an MP or the side of the MP who died. I think that's what's going to happen between now and Thursday. It'll be said quietly, but I think that's what's going to happen. There were rumours in the evening of the death that the referendum vote might actually be postponed because there's a whole lot of things you cannot say publicly because of contempt of court rules when a man is going to face trial. But I think that's where we are with this referendum at the moment. A more pleasant question, please. I'll try and give a more pleasant answer. Your question was fine. It's a brilliant question. How will the disparate groups win? They will follow the example of Chester. The city of Chester has one parliamentary seat, and at the last election, the city of Chester was won by the Labour Party by about 95 votes. And the reason Labour won Chester by 95 votes, we mustn't tell anybody because they're very naughty, the Greens didn't put a candidate up. Now, you're not allowed to do that by the National Party rules. The Greens didn't put the candidate up because the Conservative candidate was pro-fracking and they're going to frack on the edge of Chester. If you don't put up two different candidates and you let people know if you want to vote Green, vote Labour, you can win. Oxford West and Abingdon, Nicola Blackwood, my local Conservative MP. She was up against the Liberal Party, the Labour Party, nice woman from Oxfam, National Health Alliance, nice local GP, and the Greens, also very nice. Four candidates against the Conservative. There must not be four candidates in 2020. Labour and the Greens are already talking to each other in Oxford West and Abingdon. National Health Alliance is getting close to deciding not to put the candidate up. What you need to do next is get the Liberals to talk to Labour and the Greens. And you probably have to get somebody who joins the Liberal Party, but is in all other cases somebody who is always green and red, to stand. We have a corrupt voting system. The first-past-the-post system is not democratic. Economically unequal countries tend to have undemocratic voting systems. For one election, we're going to need some better organisation than before to win it. The Shadow Chancellor, John MacDonald, has said he's in favour of putting PR in the Labour manifesto. You put it in the manifesto, you don't need a referendum. You get in, you've got it. So for one election, these parties need to work together. The Greens will do anything if you put in PR. You identify geographically five seats for the Greens, and Labour walks out of those five seats. They are... Actually, you've really got to keep this quiet. Do you know there's a boundary review underway? Yeah. And the seats are going to be redrawn? Yeah. Hopefully the Conservatives will do this. They think they're going to gain 20 seats, because, of course, the population moves south in Tory areas. So don't oppose it. Let them do it. When the boundary review happens, every seat is new. Nobody owns a seat. Every candidate MP has to be reselected. See what's going to happen in the Labour Party. by a lot of the parliamentary Labour Party are suddenly beginning to like Jeremy Corbyn because their local party will have to re-select them. When the seats are redrawn, nobody owns a seat. Bristol West will be a new Bristol West. You'll have a new seat in Norwich. There'll be a new one in York and a new one in Holborn, and there's one down in Brighton. Those five seats Labour walks out of. You get five Caroline Lucases, and the Greens eco-cycle their way out of the other 590-odd seats, whatever they will be. But you also work with Liberals, again. Just the Liberals without Clegg. That's the way I put it. There's lots that can be done. There's potentially a lot of time. And then you get PR. I don't care what system of PR you get. And once you've got PR, you can actually vote for what you believe in, which most people in the rest of the continent that we're going to choose to stay in and celebrate that choice, if we make it, for an entire generation, they already have that choice. We have so much to learn from other places. It is not our fault we got to this. Nobody else had an empire the size we did. Nobody else had the colonies we had. There are lots of ways in which you can explain how we've come to be where we are today. But this is where we are. If we are going to have to get ourselves out of it, all our old ages, particularly my old age, is going to be very, very bad. Because you do not want to be spending your last 5 years of life in a country like this country, being cared for by people paid as little as we pay our care workers, relying on the health service that we currently have and the housing system we have, with your children hoping you might die a little bit earlier so that they can get the money they need to get out of renting. That isn't the future we should be looking forward to. My children get the money if you buy this book. Come on, stand up, Izzy. Izzy's going to be just outside the tent with some books. They are £8. She's got some change. If you want to get any of the facts, please go and see Izzy outside. And all the money is donated to Izzy and Robbie if he helps as well. Thank you very, very much. Thank you.
And he's on again tomorrow at 10 o'clock. He's doing People and Places, the 21st Century Atlas of Britain. I've seen it and it's absolutely incredible, so really, really recommend it. We're going to have a quick check. Can I just give, actually, Danny, I do think you're absolutely amazing. I didn't get to applause. Can we do it again?
Thank you.